The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Variety Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericavariety.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Good morning. It's time to get inside the minds of top mystery writers and behind the pages of your favorite mystery novel. Welcome to Mystery Matters, where murder is an open book, featuring your host, Fran Stewart. We'll explore how authors weave clues together to form intricate puzzles and more. Now, here's your host, Fran Stewart.
Welcome to Mystery Matters. Today is November 13th, 2009, and I'm speaking live this morning with Kelly Stanley, author of the Roman noir Nox Dormienda and A Story of San Francisco in 1940, City of Dragons. Each book is the beginning of a series. Nox Dormienda introduces Arcturus, a physician and something of an investigator. City of Dragons brings us Miranda Corby, a tough PI who used to work for an escort service. And now I'm honored to introduce Kelly Stanley. Welcome to Mystery Matters, Kelly.
Thank you, Fran. It's wonderful to be here. It's an honor to spend Friday the 13th with you in Mystery Matters, and thank you so much for having me.
Friday the 13th is a particularly important date, isn't it?
Absolutely, especially to mystery writers.
Very appropriate. Well, I'd like to spend this first segment of Mystery Matters talking about your first book, and then we'll get to City of Dragons in the second section. Is that okay with you?
That's perfect.
Okay. So first, tell us a little bit about what Nox Dormienda means and how you got the idea of a Roman noir. Can you explain what it is? Maybe tell us a little bit about the book.
Well, sure. First of all, Nox Dormienda is basically Latin for the big sleep. I'm a huge Raymond Chandler fan. He's been an instrumental influence on my writing, mm-hmm. and really sort of inspired me to experiment and cross genres as I did with my first book, which was Nox Dormienda. And I wrote it while I was in graduate school pursuing and earning a degree in classics. And, you know, one of the things I did
Fits right in.
Absolutely. And one of the things I did as a classic scholar and that I really enjoyed was translation. And I thought about how can I translate this culture in a fictional way, kind of, you know, inspired by Stephen Saylor and Lindsay Davis's success. How can I translate it in a new and interesting way that is also really appealing to me as a writer? And I'm also, obviously, I have an abiding love of noir and hard-boiled literature, and I've always been a big fan of the 20s, 30s, and 40s historically. I'm very much drawn to that era. So the idea just sort of came to me after watching a lot of film noir and reading a lot of hard-boiled literature, of combining the two mediums of a Roman-based historical mystery with a style that people would perhaps, who don't necessarily read Roman mysteries, with a style that they would find more accessible through a sort of noir lens. And that's why that's how Nox Dormienda came about, and that's why it's called basically The Big Sleep. It's an homage to Chandler's first book.
Yeah. Well, you combined those elements very successfully, I must say.
Oh, thank you. It was a challenge because, you know, you have to, as you know from being a writer, you have to be, if you're doing anything historical, you have to be careful not to make it an anachronistic. And it might sound strange because I'm writing in a noir terms, but what I mean by that is I couldn't use phrases that used obvious references to things that were post-dated from Rome. In other words, you couldn't say, put the cards on the table.
Yeah.
Because there were no playing cards. So that's the kind of thing. And, so I had to be very creative with the way I used the style and try to be true to my classical roots, but at the same time give people a flavor of what hard-boiled literature is.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, your main character, Arcturus, is He's part city, he's part country. And as I was reading your bio, I saw that you grew up without a telephone and you had to walk a quarter mile to pump water and all that. You lived in the mountains and now you're a city person. So was Arcturus's progress through life partly based on yours?
I think definitely part of his ability to connect with both the urban and non-urban environments is based on my own experiences. And I'm fortunate in that, you know, the time we're writing about, obviously there wasn't too much urbanity, as it were, in Britain, because, you know, the Romans did represent city life. They were the quintessential city culture. And Arcturus is half Roman and half British. So even in terms of his ancestry, he sort of represents that division between urban and rural. And as for me, you know, I do resonate with both halves. I spent my high school years in Northern California in Humboldt County and in the Redwood Country. And my parents had a riding stable, and I grew up with horses, which plays a major role in Nox Dormienda as well as the sequel, Cursed. And, you know, I miss that. I miss it. I miss being able to wake up and smell that fresh air in the morning and hear the chickens and all that stuff. But at the same time, I love urban life. I love the culture it represents. I love being able to go to a play and go to see a symphony and feeling the energy of a lot of people around me. So I basically try to have it both ways, in that I live in the city, but whenever possible, I go up there to see my folks, and we still have 40 acres where I, you know, spent my high school and junior high years, and that's where I, you know, had to walk a quarter of a mile to pump water and so forth, and we still don't have electricity there, although we do have a generator and kerosene and, you know, gas lighting and so forth. And, you know, I can go up there as sort of a retreat, and then I can refuel and refresh that part of me that really needs to connect back with nature. So that's how I address it. And, you know, for Arcturus, basically he just has to ride a horse a few miles out of town of Londinium, and he's very much connected with nature, because it's it wasn't so separate then.
Mm-hmm. But still, he has his Roman name, he has his native name, he's between the two cultures in a way that a lot of the other people in the book aren't. In fact, I think he's the only one that's like that.
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the things I wanted to do is I think that a PI, and Arcturus is essentially a PI, although he's trained as a doctor, because I'm interested in Roman medicine, and I also wanted a plausible reason for him to become involved in murder investigations. Mm-hmm. I think a PI is always someone who is someone who doesn't exactly fit in. He's always an outsider. You know, you think of, say, the Old West cowboy hero, the person who comes in and solves the problem and then rides out of town again. Mm-hmm. I think the PI is largely based on that sort of mythic icon. And, you know, he has to be able to operate within the law, but he is not part of the law. He has to pursue justice, but he's not recognized as an official arm of the government or anyone else. So I really wanted to make Arcturus through and through a character that literally did not fit in, who was not comfortable in a part of, in a real ensconced part of either culture. Mm-hmm. And so that is why he is both Roman and not Roman, and both British and not British, and why he is able to sort of maneuver his way through the different competing societies and cliques and classes and everything else. And I think that's what makes him an effective PI character.
Yeah, he definitely is that.
Thank you. I like him. I'm very happy to be able to continue the series with Thomas Dunn Minotaur Books, and in fact, they recently just purchased the sequel to Nox. So I don't have a publishing date yet, but will soon. So I'm real happy, because, you know, it's my first book. It was the first book I ever tried to write, and and I'm very attached. I get attached to my characters.
What sort of things did you learn as a first-time writer?
Well, I learned that I should have started earlier in terms of learning, if that makes sense. I really didn't join any groups like Sisters in Crime or Mystery Writers of America or International Thriller Writers and really educate myself before I received my publishing contract for two reasons. One, I was in graduate school. I wrote Knox, and my head was wrapped around finishing my thesis and wondering what I was going to do after I received my MA. And two, I really lacked the confidence at the time to invest in myself. I wanted to get, I guess, I wanted to be reassured that I would be able to, you know, that it was worthy of being submitted to an agent, it was worthy of being submitted to an editor. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't join groups. I should have. And the first thing I did when I did get my publishing contract was to start making contacts and educating myself about publishing and in this community. And I found that it is the single most wonderful community I've ever been honored to be a part of. You're an example of that, Fran, with this wonderful show. International Thriller Writers has a debut author program that I joined right away that was instrumental in helping me learn and meet people and just sort of get a PhD in publishing before my book came out, you know, and really learning and understanding the industry.
Are you so, like the rest of us? You churned out about 12 books before you finally got around to writing the one that...
Well, no, actually, this was the first book I ever tried to write.
It totally was. Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, so I that's another reason why I was so unsure and hesitant about investing, mm-hmm. you know, because it's the first time I tried to do it, so I really, you know, I liked it, but, you know, it didn't mean anything.
I was kind of like that with my first book. I had actually tried to start a bunch of mysteries ahead of time before that, but they bored me, so I figured they were pretty awful. But Orange is Marmalade was really the first full book that I wrote, so I guess we've got something in common there.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it is a very scary process. I mean, it's because you don't have I didn't follow any blueprint. I mean, really, the only class I had in writing was reading a lot of really great authors, and I still think that's probably the best
kind,
class.
Though, of learning ground, I guess, if you want. I mean,
absolutely,
you have to be a good reader,
I think,
in order to be a good writer.
I think it's important. I think it's crucial.
Yeah.
And, you know, even Chandler...
I need to interrupt you because we are coming up on a break. But right after the break, I'm going to continue my discussion with Kelly Stanley, author of Nox Dormienda and City of Dragons. Please stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Talk, talk, talk. That's all we do is talk.
Yeah!
If you'd like to talk, call us toll-free right now at 1-866-472-5787. 1-866-472-5787.
That's it.
VoiceAmerica.com.
Do you love a good mystery?
The cozy murder mystery comes alive with Fran Stewart. Step into the world of Biscuit McKee and her cat Marmalade, where murder happens in odd and unpredictable ways. Fran Stewart imbues her characters with warmth and humor while maintaining their eccentricities and vulnerabilities. Before you reach the end of the book, you'll fall in love with Biscuit and Marmalade and want to move to Martinsville, where everything is better after a big mug of foaming hot heaven at the local deli. Visit www.franstewart.com for a complete list of books. Start with Fran's first book, Orange as Marmalade, and continue in the series to her latest book, Indigo as an Iris. Settle into your favorite chair with a Fran Stewart mystery. You won't be disappointed. www.franstewart.com. That's Fran Stewart, StewartSTEWART.com.
Are you ready to go green?
You've asked, and we've heard you. Voice America presents the Green Talk Network.
environmental topics are at the forefront of our society, and the Green Talk Network is here to keep you up to date on the latest trends and new innovations for the eco-conscious lifestyle. We'll help promote a variety of ideas on the environment, from global warming issues to how you can become more eco-friendly in your daily activities. Be a part of the solution, not the problem. Visit the Green Talk Network page on voiceamerica.com and tune in to help spread the green. Self-leadership is more important than corporate leadership. In the hustle and bustle world we live in, we need to be reminded that in all failures and successes, we are the common denominators. Each week, let Daniel Gutierrez help bring you the tools you need to manage self-leadership, resulting in self-success. Make your mark in your industry. Make sure you listen to Right Here, Right Now, every Thursday at 11 a.m. Pacific Time, 2 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.
Stimulating talk.
It gets those synapses in the brain firing really fast.
All the time. The number one internet talk station where your opinion counts. VoiceAmerica.com.
You're enjoying Mystery Matters, where murder is an open book, with your host, Fran Stewart. If you have a question or comment about the show, please feel free to send an email to Fran at mysterymatters@earthlink.net. That's mysterymatters@earthlink.net. Now let's get back inside a great mystery.
I'm speaking today with Kelly Stanley, author of Nox Dormienda and City of Dragons. Her website is kellystanley.com, and despite what the nice lady on the voiceover said introducing this show, my email is down today for some reason. So if you have questions for Kelly Stanley, I truly am apologetic, but there's no way to get through to me. Kelly, let's continue. You were talking about Raymond Chandler.
Yeah, I was talking about how, you know, it can be very daunting when you think, oh, I need to have this class, or I need to have read this book, I need to have this degree in order to write. But basically, if you have a story inside of you, I think you need to get it out. And don't worry about publication at the moment, just get out the story. You know, it could be family history, it could be something that you just want to write, it could be anything. But if you feel that impulse, give into it. And I was going to mention that Chandler himself is considered one of the greatest of all writers within the hard-boiled and mystery genre. Not only that, but within American literature, in general, taught himself how to write by deconstructing an Earl Stanley Gardner book and then reconstructing it. So he taught himself by reading other authors and experimenting. And that's sort of, you know, you can do that too. So, and certainly that's, you know, that's what I did. I didn't take any writing classes in college. I was solely interested in classics in terms of pursuing a degree. But I read an awful lot, and I've grown up reading, and that has served me in good stead. That was my writing school.
Yeah, I always did that, and every author I've spoken with in this whole year of Mystery Matters has said the same thing, that you have to start reading if you want to write. Because that's how we learn. So
absolutely.
Well,
whether it's conscious or unconscious.
City of Dragons. Now, there are 2,000 years between the setting of Nox Dormienda and City of Dragons, because City of Dragons is 1940 San Francisco. Are there similarities between these two time periods?
Well, in my head, yes. I'm a sort of historian, even as a scholar, who always saw and tried to see probably the common bond of humanity in every era. It's very easy to see the differences because they're obvious ones in terms of dress, in terms of habit, in terms of faith, in terms of daily life. But, you know, if you distill it down to the essence of what people felt and what motivated people, then you'd have to say yes. People haven't changed that much. In terms of the specific, similarities between Roman Britain and the noir world of 1940 San Francisco, I'd say, you know, you're dealing with a fairly corrupt system that doesn't always work. It didn't work very well in 1940, and it didn't work very well for Arcturus and Roman Britain. You're dealing
with that. You have good people too that try to make a difference.
Exactly. And that's basically what both eras have in common, and it's what they have in common historically. You know, I mean, if you read, there are books that compile grave inscriptions from the Roman era, and it's easy to say, well, maybe the ancients didn't have as high respect for life because they had gladiatorial combats and stuff. But if you read some of these grave inscriptions, you'd realize that's not necessarily true. In fact, it wasn't true. And there are many poems that are dedicated to lost loved ones. And, you know, there was a respect for life. There was a feeling of loss. There was pain. There was crime, just as there is now and just as there was in 1940.
Yeah. And history books always seem to be written around wars that were fought.
I think that's a really good observation, yeah.
Yeah, there's a whole other life, a whole lot of other lives out there besides the war-related ones.
I think one reason is because, you know, in a war, it's easy to lose sight of the individual.
Yeah.
And murder is often about the individual, you know, in the way we write it.
Yeah. I'm really glad I had a chance to read an advanced copy of City of Dragons. Thank you for letting me do that.
Oh, my pleasure.
It's coming out in January?
February 2nd.
February, okay. Well, you had originally intended to call it Rice Bowl.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, having read it, I know how that fits right into the story, but can you tell our listeners about that?
Well, sure. City of Dragons takes place actually, literally at a festival in Chinatown in San Francisco in 1940. It was a festival held in most Chinatowns across the country that was a fundraiser for Sino-Japanese war relief. You know, China had been at war with Japan long before we entered World War II and were at war with Japan. And after the invasion of Nanking and the rape of Nanking, the city, in 1937, there was great agitation and obvious distress in the Chinese-American community. There were boycotts at the Japanese business. There was a lot of racial tension between the two communities, and they were often close together, or they were often forced to live in the same area.
Mm-hmm.
And they held, the Chinese-American communities across the country held these things called rice bowl parties that were to raise money to help China war relief in the war against Japan. Mm-hmm. And, of course, in the opening of City of Dragons, a young man who's 18 or 19, who's a numbers runner, a minor kind of hoodlum, and also happens to be Japanese-American, is shot during one of these rice bowl parties. And the authorities want it all to go away, and they just want to chalk it up to somebody shot him because he's Japanese, and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
But my character is with him when he dies, Miranda Corby. She's my protagonist, and Miranda doesn't want it to just stay that way. She wants to pursue justice and find out who killed Eddie Takahashi.
Yeah. Let's talk about Miranda. She's a former escort. She's addicted to smoking. She drinks, swears. She's a reflection of some heavy social themes. Was that a conscious choice, or did it just kind of emerge as you started writing her?
Well, both, in a way. First of all, Miranda, I wanted to create a character that had a lot of attributes of a femme fatale, but instead of putting her in the villainous role and demonizing her as you find in a lot of noir, which tends to be on the misogynistic side,
mm-hmm.
I wanted her to be the protagonist. So I'm taking a femme fatale and putting her in the Seamus role. The social themes emerged because this is a time and a place where there was a great deal of philosophy, a great deal of passion. There was a generation of people who really felt that they could change the world with an ism. There were communists in America at the time who really passionately believed that communism would change the misery that they saw during the Great Depression. Mm. Obviously, there were fascists, you know, who were not interested in helping other people, but basically in spewing a lot of hatred. But it's still an ism. There was socialism, socialists who were also offering an alternative to what they saw as a broken system. And in the meantime, there were a lot of causes. The Spanish Civil War is one that Miranda was involved in as a former volunteer nurse. And I think that sometimes the most cynical people that I certainly have ever met in life were people who have tried and had that impulse to help and had that impulse to really commit themselves to a cause and then see it crumble and see that it didn't do any good. And for, as you know from reading the book, for a variety of reasons, Miranda is what I would call a broken idealist. Mm-hmm. And so I think that her social background is part of her generation. It's part of the times, and it's also one of those things that makes her a dark character at this particular point, although she still is committed to trying to help Eddie Takahashi, as I explained. So she hasn't completely lost her idealism.
I have to thank you for creating the character of Miranda, because she made me face up to some of my built-in prejudices. I normally don't read noir stories. I don't watch noir movies because mm-hmm. I guess I'm something of a snob when it comes to smoking and drinking and swearing and, you know, all of that stuff. I don't smoke, but, you know, I do the other stuff occasionally, but mm-hmm. I don't like myself when I do it. And mm-hmm. all of a sudden, here I was faced with a character whose motivation was enough to make me sit back and say, wait a minute, Fran, what are you doing here? You know, and once I was willing to accept her for who and what she was, what she is, she seems very alive to me. Then I think I grew myself through reading this book. So I thank you.
Oh, Fran, thank you so much. That is absolutely just touches my heart. And it's really what one of the things I'd like to try to accomplish with Miranda, because I don't do anything gratuitously. I don't believe in gratuitous mm-hmm. violence or anything really in a book. I'm very, very character oriented and character driven. I like to say that the characters write themselves, and in a lot of ways it seems that they do, and they do mm-hmm. things that I don't even expect at times.
Yeah.
And Miranda, you know, what she does and what she does, there's a self-destructive element in it for a variety of reasons, and that's part of who she is, and it's not an affectation, in other words. So I'm very, very happy that she was able to touch you in that way, because then that makes me feel very good about the book. I appreciate
it. You did good.
Thank you.
And on that note, we have another break coming up. So I'm going to continue my discussion with Kelly Stanley, and stay tuned. We'll be right back.
News. Opinion.
Can you hear me?
Your voice counts. Call toll-free 1-866-472-5787. 1-866-472-5787. VoiceAmerica.com.
Do you love a good mystery?
The cozy murder mystery comes alive with Fran Stewart. Step into the world of Biscuit McKee and her cat Marmalade, where murder happens in odd and unpredictable ways. Fran Stewart imbues her characters with warmth and humor while maintaining their eccentricities and vulnerabilities. Before you reach the end of the book, you'll fall in love with Biscuit and Marmalade and want to move to Martinsville, where everything is better after a big mug of foaming hot heaven at the local deli. Visit www.franstewart.com for a complete list of books. Start with Fran's first book, Orange as Marmalade, and continue in the series to her latest book, Indigo as an Iris. Settle into your favorite chair with a Fran Stewart mystery. You won't be disappointed. www.franstewart.com. That's Fran Stewart, STEWART.com.
The latest business information is made simple with the Voice America Business Network. The professionals in the business world bring you live talk radio shows featuring an array of business topics, strategies for building wealth, sales and marketing, stock trading, investing, and business technology. Voice America Business hosts are professionals in their fields and bring to the airwaves weekly business discussions that offer up-to-date information, advice, and education. The Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business talk. Streaming live, the leader in Internet talk radio, VoiceAmerica.com.
You're enjoying Mystery Matters, where murder is an open book, with your host, Fran Stewart. If you have a question or comment about the show, please feel free to send an email to Fran at mysterymatters@earthlink.net. That's mysterymatters@earthlink.net. Now let's get back inside a great mystery.
My guest today is Kelly Stanley, author of City of Dragons. So, Kelly, you'll be juggling two series, it sounds like, the Arcturus series and the Miranda. Are you going to stick to those for a while, or do you have some standalones on the horizon, or what's going on?
Well, I definitely want to get these series off the ground, and, you know, I have a day job, so it sort of depends on how well both series are, you know, do so that I can find out whether or not. I work part-time. If I can carve more time out, I'd love to do a standalone set in Humboldt County because it is such a distinct and unique place, and I have such a long-term connection with it, and I think it would be real interesting to write a standalone thriller there. I have ambitions to write a graphic novel because at one point in my life we owned a comic book store with my mom, and so I have a great affection for and knowledge of the graphic novel and comic book forms. You know, I'd like to write a lot of different things, but those are the two that bubble up past these series.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you still have a lot of years ahead of you, so.
Thank you.
City of Dragons reads like a 1940s song sings. Does that make sense?
Yeah, thank you. I was trying to capture that.
Good. Well, you did. So you actually tried that right from the start, or was it something you had to go back and do rewriting to get to? Or,
well, I've been, as a writer, I'm heavily influenced by poetry. I actually wrote poetry consistently throughout my life, whereas I didn't write prose. And so I'm very sensitive to rhythm, and I was trying to really get across to readers that this period of time, one of the distinct differences between now and 1940 is that a lot of information and a lot of cultural bonding was done around auditory things, like radio, like popular music and songs.
Yeah,
exactly. We didn't have television. If you wanted to see what was on the news, you'd have to go to a movie so you can see the newsreels. Mm-hmm. So I was really wanting to capture that sort of feeling of hearing all around you. And I like to really make sure I tap into all the senses when I write anyway, especially if you're writing anything that's historical. You really want it to come alive for the reader. So that was one of my goals, is to sort of have a lyricism to the writing as well as capture the lyrical quality of living in a more audio-oriented age.
Yeah. You use a lot of song lyrics in the book, and I found myself wanting to sing along as I was reading. Because I remember all of those songs. I was born in the 40s, and so a lot of those were songs that I grew up with.
Well, a lot of them are standards, and unfortunately, we can't. You have the advanced reading copy, but a lot of those song lyrics we had to cut back. I had to rewrite some of those scenes because of permissions issues.
Oh, fool!
But no, they're still there. We have at least one line of every lyric,
okay.
And they're all. It's still definitely referred to, and I've tried to rewrite it so that you get the exact same feeling.
Yeah.
But because of legal questions, you have to be very careful these days about.
Yeah, that's always a one of those hard points to get around.
It is, but I think we managed to convey the same feeling, which is really the whole point of letting you, you know, if you have a memory of that song, you're going to think, oh yeah, I remember Martha Tilton singing "And the Angels Sing," and you know, it'll or you know, someone will watch over me or try a little tenderness. And yeah, I'm a big fan of standards and jazz. I listen to a lot of it.
What do you love most about being a writer? Is that a fair question?
Well, it could easily fill an hour by itself, but I'll try
We don't have that long.
I know. I'll try to be brief.
What do you love?
Well, I think I'll tell you the most unexpected thing I love about being a writer, because I think, you know, we all love to write, otherwise we wouldn't have tried to be successfully published. The most unexpected thing I love is the community. I, you know, spend a great deal of time in the academy as a scholar, and where I had wonderful experiences and wonderful mentors and people who are very important to me. But as a culture, I find that the writing community, particularly the mystery writing community or thriller writing community, is so supportive and so amazingly collegial and just like a big happy family. I mean, everyone is just amazingly supportive. It's the only word that keeps coming back to me. And we all support one another. We all bond. It's such a wonderful feeling of belonging and togetherness. And I haven't found that in any other community, corporate wise or certainly in the academy, and that to me is the most unexpected delight, the biggest unexpected delight of being published.
You know, somebody, I was speaking to a book club once about my books, and somebody said something about I read a book by one of your competitors, and I thought, who on earth would that be? You know, mm-hmm. I'm competing with it, and she was talking about another mystery, and you know, you're not my competitor. Nobody I've interviewed here is my competitor, and I'm not their competitor.
Exactly, and that's how we think. And it's completely the opposite in university circles. So,
yeah.
You know, that was like such a breath of fresh air. And then being able to talk to readers, to talk to librarians and bookstore owners, I mean, just the people who love mysteries, the people...
Yeah.
Who make books and literacy a mission, who spend their days trying to get people to read more. I mean, it's just an honor to be part of this community.
Yeah, yeah. That's great. Do you have a normal writing day? I mean, you said you have a part-time job. How do you work your writing in? What does a regular day look like at your house?
Well, I don't know if I even have normal days at all at this point. It's been kind of crazy lately because we're at the 3-month mark before, a little over the 3-month mark before City of Dragons comes out. Well, you know, you have to juggle a lot of things. As you very well know, being a writer, you have to juggle the writing along with the necessary marketing and PR because increasingly the onus for that is on the writer. And I enjoy that part of it, so it's not as harrowing for me as it is for some of my friends mm-hmm. who are more introverted and they have a hard time making themselves do it. But the hardest part really is the time. So I'm just very disciplined. I come home from the day job and I have time carved out where when I'm working like I am now on the sequel to City of Dragons, I just sit down and I work. And I don't check my email until after I get done a certain amount of pages or a certain amount of words.
Yeah.
Because
do you outline before a book or do you kind of write as you go?
I do both, actually. I always outline a general outline so that I can make sure I'm hitting the places that I need to hit that I want to go in terms of pacing. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, it's a very general kind of schematic map. And as I narrow in, as I start to write and things start to happen, then I start breaking it down more specifically, and I can kind of see where I'm going. It's kind of like traveling through a tunnel, and you have a little light on your head on one of those helmets, and you can only see so far ahead.
Yeah.
I can kind of see vaguely the end, and I know what I want to happen, some of the big peaks, mm-hmm. but I don't know the details until I'm actually down there on the ground.
So you get surprised every once in a while, huh?
I do. Yeah. I do. Sometimes characters wind up playing more of a role, less of a role. Sometimes new characters come in that I didn't plan on.
Do you have a favorite minor character?
In City of Dragons? One of my favorites is Benta Gallagher, because her name is actually that of one of my dear friends who's also a mystery writer. Jenny Bentley is a pseudonym for Benta Gallagher, and she's actually going to have two series now coming out, one underneath Jenny and one from under Benta. And we were talking one day, and her name just sparked the entire character. It was sort of, it came to me because of, we were, you know, it's an unusual name. It's Norwegian and Irish.
Mm-hmm.
And so I will always have a very particular fondness for Banta's character because of that personal connection.
Mm-hmm. That's great. What about in the Arcturus story, Knock?
Well, you know, in my household, my family likes Billico.
Yeah.
I love Billico too. But he's a big favorite. And I'm usually getting badgered by friends or family of, when's Billico going to have his own series? When's Billico? I've promised that one of the things I'd like to do is write a book of short stories of Billico's exploits.
Oh, that would be fun.
Kind of like what Agatha Christie did with The Labors of Hercules for Poirot, except this might be The Labors of Billico. So I'm thinking about something like that. If I could swing it, I think it would be a lot of fun.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, that's neat. The I'm trying to think of who it was. Oh, 2 weeks ago I interviewed Dirk Robertson, and he said, I asked him about developing his characters, and he said he never patterns them after a particular person, but what he does is he takes 25% of this person and 25% of that person. You know, maybe this person's history, that person's physical characteristics, and other. How do you put your characters together?
I really, you know, they just come about somehow between my head and my fingers. I don't consciously ever build them in mm-hmm. terms of percentages or anything else. As I said, when I was talking to Benta, I knew I had to have this character do something, you know, play this particular role. I had an idea for it, but she hadn't really taken shape. And when I talked to Benta and that name registered, the character sort of came out of the name.
Yeah.
Sometimes it happens that way. Sometimes the character comes out as I'm writing, which is most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I sort of see the writing unfolds like a film. I'm very film-oriented. I wrote a few screenplays, actually, before I wrote my first novel, and I think that experience helped me be able to visualize as I write, and it also definitely helped me with dialogue.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, your dialogue's very effective. So.
Thank you.
Well, here we are coming up on the third break, so let's do that, and this is where I'd ordinarily say email your questions, but my email is down, so I apologize for that. In the meantime, stay tuned, and we will be right back with Kelly Stanley, author of City of Dragons.
Talk, talk, talk. That's all we do is talk.
Yeah!
If you'd like to talk, call us toll-free right now at 1-866-472-5787. 1-866-472-5787.
That's it.
VoiceAmerica.com.
Do you love a good mystery?
The cozy murder mystery comes alive with Fran Stewart. Step into the world of Biscuit McKee and her cat Marmalade, where murder happens in odd and unpredictable ways. Fran Stewart imbues her characters with warmth and humor while maintaining their eccentricities and vulnerabilities. Before you reach the end of the book, you'll fall in love with Biscuit and Marmalade and want to move to Martinsville, where everything is better after a big mug of foaming hot heaven at the local
Belly. Visit www.franstewart.com for a complete list of books. Start with Fran's first book, Orange as Marmalade, and continue in the series to her latest book, Indigo as an Iris. Settle into your favorite chair with a Fran Stewart mystery. You won't be disappointed. www.franstewart.com. That's Fran Stewart, STEWART.com.
Voice America Network proudly presents The Catherine Zox Show for women, men, children, and families. Catherine magically combines her compassion, experience, and talent to bring listeners a show that's upbeat, informative, and yes, a little sassy. Tune in every Wednesday at 7 a.m. Pacific Time, 10 a.m. Eastern, to The Catherine Zox Show on the Voice America channel.
When your car starts to gasp and sputter, you take it in for a tune-up. But what about when you get tired and need help? Sounds like it's time for a life tune-up. Simple, straightforward advice and techniques to help inspire and guide you in weathering life's challenges and finding your true purpose. Each week, Lauren and Shore Slocum will give you the tools to tune up your life in a way that's easy and fun. Stop making excuses and live your life. Tune in to Life Tune-Ups, Thursdays at 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern on the Voice America Variety Channel, and tune up your life today.
The Internet's number one talk station.
Number one talk station.
VoiceAmerica.com.
You're enjoying Mystery Matters, where murder is an open book, with your host, Fran Stewart. If you have a question or comment about the show, please feel free to send an email to Fran at mysterymatters@earthlink.net. That's mysterymatters@earthlink.net. Now let's get back inside a great mystery.
If you're just joining us on Mystery Matters, my guest today is Kelly Stanley. Kelly, remind us again how to reach your website.
Well, it's all the typical HTTP stuff, followed by www.kelly, K-E-L-L-I, Stanley, STANLEY.com.
Okay. Have you heard of my newest abbreviation? It's 3-dub-dot.
Oh, I love it.
www. I mean,
that's good. I like it.
10 syllables there, you know. So.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. KellyStanley.com. Kelly, what would you say makes a good villain?
I'd say what makes a good villain is what makes any good character, which is believability. I think, you know, if we're dealing with genre fiction, there are certain conventions and that there are certain willingness of disbelief, a suspension of disbelief that the reader brings to it. But at the same time, if you push the reader too far and the character does something that is illogical or in violation of a pattern that you've previously set up, you'll lose the reader because you've pushed them too far into the realm of impossibility. So I think you really need to make your villains believable. You need to make them shaded. You need to make them, in my case, I want to see a villain that's well-rounded, that's got an understandable motivation. Mm-hmm. And, you know, depending on how prominent that the role of that villain is. And I want to believe in it.
Mm-hmm. I also think a villain needs to have just enough good in there somewhere to, I guess that's what makes a person more human. And as you say, more believable.
Yeah, it's that shades. It's not the, you know, if you have the guy in the top hat and the wax mustache tying up a damsel in distress at the railroad track, it's, you know, it's, it doesn't really work anymore.
Two dimensional.
So. You know, and you want to see a villain that you can not necessarily admire at all, or not necessarily even be that charismatic. Although, say, like Hannibal Lecter is an example of the charismatic almost hero villain. But you know, you want to see one that is ultimately enough of a complex character to make you come back for more, especially if it's a continuing villain.
Yeah, very much so. You know, there are so many subdivisions within the mystery genre. Where would you say your books fit?
Well, Monster Mienda, I would say, is a lighter version of hard-boiled, technically. It does have a few noir elements. And I think most people identify noir and hard-boiled. They come from the same school, ultimately. And you can get into all kinds of hair-raising debates about that at conferences and so forth. But, you know, I think it's a lighter version of that genre, of course, mixed with the historical mystery element. And City of Dragons is, I would say, a very dark, hard-boiled book with a lot of noir elements. But as we were chatting earlier off air, I don't write books that don't have an element of some sort of redemption. I don't like to write about things that, to me, are easy. In other words, I think it's easy to feel hopeless, and it's easy to see, yeah, the world needs some help, and things are pretty bleak at any period that you're writing about.
Yeah.
So I like to write about people who are trying to do something about something, even if they're dark, even if they've got issues, even if their characters are broken idealists. The fact is that we still all have to try to make the world a better place. So I guess that sounds very odd for a quote-unquote noir writer, but that's the way I approach that genre.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever been in a position where you've been in danger?
Where I've been in danger on a personal level, or
no,
while I was doing
the way Miranda has been and Arcturus, your character.
Yeah, I actually have, and I was talking with this. I was talking about this with my mom, and I also talked about it actually at a meeting with Sisters in Crime for the university. What is it, American? The University Women of America. It's an American mm-hmm. university organization for women. Excuse me, and. I was talking in both cases about how women often feel like prey once they hit adolescence. And there's just a certain sense and an awareness that you are being targeted on a sexual basis. Mm-hmm. And this is something that my grandmother went through. I actually remember discussing some of this with her.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something that I think generations of women face. And it's not something that we often talk about, and I don't mean to exaggerate it, but it is something that we as women have to live with.
Yeah.
And that is one of the elements that I wanted to bring to Miranda and really bring out in City of Dragons is the fact that we as women live with a sense of danger that men don't necessarily share.
Mm-hmm.
And I've certainly experienced it in my life. My mom has experienced it in her life, and virtually every woman I've spoken with about it has experienced it, and they understand immediately what I'm talking about.
I remember some time ago reading about a survey that was done where they were asking men and women the same question, and the question was, if you're in a grocery store at night and you're walking out of the grocery store to go to your car, what do you do? And the men all said, huh? I walk to my car. Whereas the women said, I look around, I check, you know, whether there are other people, who they are. I've made sure to park my car fairly close to begin with. I have my key in my hand ready to go. And it never occurred to the men to do anything like that.
Exactly. It's not just the idea that, unfortunately, the victim idea is not something I want to perpetuate, and it's something that has been too long in popular culture, the image of the woman in distress in films and so forth. And I think I've adequately addressed that with the protagonist of Miranda, because she is very capable of taking care of herself. But it's that feeling of that you're being marked, you know, that you have to be aware, that you're forced to be aware, and you're forced to be aware because someone's always going to, in her case in particular, because she's attractive, someone's going to be hitting on her constantly.
Yeah.
And that sort of sexual harassment was something that wasn't considered harassment necessarily, but it could still be. It was still felt as harassment, but it was something that they had to deal with. I mean, yeah. Rape laws were...
And that's just the way things were then.
Exactly. Rape laws were not progressive in 1940.
Yeah. Well, hopefully some things have changed since then. And, Kelly, we've come up to the end of our hour. I'm sorry to have to cut this short now. I really appreciate the time you've spent with me this morning. I've thoroughly enjoyed our conversation.
Well, it's been an honor, Fran. You do so much for the community, and you're a stellar writer, and your radio show's phenomenal, and it's been an honor to be here. And And I want to be able to give you a call up and continue our conversation at any time because you're wonderful to talk to.
I will give you my phone number offline. Well, that concludes this week's show. If you'd like to listen again to my conversation with Kelly Stanley, the show will be archived here, and there will be a link on my website, franstewart.com. While you're there, sign up to receive my newsletter and get news about upcoming guests. Next week, on November 20th, I'll be talking with Judith Ivey. So tune in next Friday when we will again delve deeply into mysteries we love to read. Opening and closing music by Nanette Littlestone. And I'm Fran Stewart. I'm here to remind you that mystery always matters. Thank you one more time, Kelly. I really appreciate you.
Hope you enjoyed this week's inside look on Mystery Matters, where murder is an open book. Join Fran Stewart again next Friday at 7 a.m. Pacific Time, 10 a.m. Eastern Time, for another exciting edition here on Voice America.
Thanks again for listening to the preceding program brought to you on the Voice America Variety Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericavariety.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the preceding program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.